A fundamental question for curriculum thinkers of any kind is why are we teaching what we're teaching? So when we approach the idea of a science curriculum, it's important to understand what the purposes of teaching science are. It's a traditional thing to teach, of course, but why? So one obvious answer is because we want young people to know about the natural world. We'd like them to know how cells work, how gravity works, what the planets are, and so on. And that's a very valid approach. And I would say that that is probably the dominant reason that most people would think of if you were to ask them why teach science. Of course, a subset of young people will go on to study science at university, and some of them will become scientists. That may not be a particularly good argument for teaching it at high school level, because only a small proportion of them will. But it is important that we have a cadre of scientists and to train them. Another reason might be to enable people to engage in public debates about issues that involve science. So that isn't science itself, but how does science bear on perhaps political questions or social questions? Now, the fourth idea here is quite an important one to me, which is that we need to teach young people how to contest ideas and to contest them well, to contest them in good faith. And I think science has some features that make it a particularly good vehicle for doing that, but we need to be clear about what those features are. And I think that at the moment, and historically, science education has focused very much on the theories that come from science. But that is what gives us our knowledge about the natural world. So it's an obvious thing to focus on. But what is less well developed in the curriculum is the epistemology of science. That is what science is as a knowledge structure and as a set of methods for testing knowledge, for testing truth claims. And it has some unique features in that regard. And also what good scientific argumentation is. So I'm sure you're all familiar with Karl Popper, who was, you know, in my opinion, one of the greatest philosophers of the 20th century. He happened to write one of his books when he was a refugee in New Zealand during World War II. He was an Austrian Jew, and so he had to flee Europe at that time. And that's when he wrote The Open Society and Its Enemies, which is his great work of political philosophy, and one of the great works of political philosophy of the last 100 years or so. He was also, of course, a philosopher of science, and The Logic of Scientific Discovery was, I believe, also a seminal and very important work. Now, what interests me so much about Popper is what the confluence is of his political thinking and his scientific thinking. And I believe that there is a very strong confluence, and it speaks to us in the present historical moment quite strongly and warns us of some things that we need to take account of. So what, you know, in a nutshell is in common in Popper's thinking about science and his thinking about democracy and open society? So I've got through these three bullet points, and I don't claim to be exhaustive in this or by any means, but these are the things that come to my mind when I think about Popper's philosophy. So ideas are provisional. They're subject to revision and change. You never know that you've got the last word in anything. That's a really important principle. And with that comes a disposition of intellectual humility. You're not right. You might be, but you'll never know if you are. And so ideas have to continually be tested and contested. So ideas are contestable. They must be contestable. They have to be contestable in a democracy, and they have to be contestable in science in just the same way. And everything that we do to make that more difficult is both anti-democratic and anti-scientific. And I think another theme that comes through Popper's writing is that change is usually incremental, both in science and in democracy. Not always, and of course, Kuhn pointed out that sometimes we get these paradigm shifts where theoretical orientation changes very rapidly from one understanding to another. For example, when Nicholas Copernicus, who I will mention briefly later, published The Revolution of the Spheres, which positioned not the Earth but the Sun at the centre of what they knew to be the universe at that time. Radical change in theoretical stance. But normally science advances more incrementally than that. And likewise, in a democracy, Popper believed that, you know, small changes towards what people wanted and towards a better society was a better approach than revolutionary change. So these are some of the principles. So now I'm going to turn to the controversy that I mentioned, because I think it's a very good lens for thinking about what science is, what it isn't, and how some changes in the way we talk about science in education could make a big difference to how we talk about other things in our society as well. So I'm talking, of course, about the letter to the listener that was written by seven Auckland professors last year, in which they contended what they were responding to was the Ministry of Education wanting to instill Mataranga Māori or Māori traditional knowledge throughout the New Zealand curriculum, including in science. And they wrote a letter contending that these two things are different. Not, I might add hastily, that one is better than the other or superior to the other, but that they are different. Now, unless you've been living under a rock or you've recently arrived from overseas, you probably know what happened next. Various people got involved. So all of the people who wrote these things are themselves scientists, I might hasten to add. So Barry Hughes of the Tertiary Education Union wrote to these seven Auckland professors, and amongst other things, he said that members of the union found their letter offensive, racist, and reflective of patronising neo-colonial mindset. Their own Vice Chancellor, Dawn Freshwater, who's qualified in psychiatry, said that their arguments had caused considerable hurt and dismay. And then we have very prominent scientists, Susie Wiles and Sean Hendy, who orchestrated an open letter signed by some 2,500 members of university communities, saying that mistrust in science stems from science's ongoing role in perpetuating scientific racism, justifying colonialism, all of that. Now, all of this is very heated language to use. It's not very sound argument. It's got a lot of ad hominem in it and a lot of motivated reasoning. None of these things are hallmarks of good scientific thinking. But the Royal Society, I'm sorry to say, also got involved in a rather negative way. So this is part of a letter that was written by two members of the executive. The recent suggestion by a group of University of Auckland academics that Mataranga Māori is not a valid truth is utterly rejected by the Royal Society Te Aparangi. Now, of course, they didn't say anything of the sort. They did not say that Mataranga Māori was not a valid truth. They said that it wasn't science, which is not at all the same thing. And I do intend to justify that statement to you shortly. So the Royal Society instigated an investigation against three of its fellows who were members of that group of seven. They were Garth Cooper, Robert Knoller, and Michael Kabalis. Kabalis is actually a bit of an intellectual hero of mine. He was a giant in my field of cognitive psychology, international rock star, really, in that field. Unfortunately, he died before all this got wound up. But eventually, the investigation was called off, but not before people like Richard Dawkins, Jerry Coyne, and Steven Pinker as well got involved. So it took international heavyweights to pull them into line. To the great credit of the fellows of this society, many of them spoke up in defence of Cooper and Nola, who are the ones left alive at that point. Gavin Martin and 70 other fellows or so called for the resignation of these executive members. What the Royal Society does with that is up to it, but I do think that we need to draw attention to these things happening, because it's very anti-scientific what happened there. If anything could have, anyway, we'll move on. I do want this example to sit throughout this lecture, though, as a kind of focal point for thinking about the issues that I'm going to raise. So the first of those is that science and mythology are different. Not that one is better than the other, but that they are different. And I do actually want to take a moment to step away from talking about science, to talk about mythology, to make clear that I take this very seriously. So I'm delighted to see you here, Pene. Pene is an administrator at the university, and I hope you don't mind me saying, Pene, she didn't speak English until she started school. She grew up in a household where te reo Māori was the language spoken, and she supported me very greatly at the beginning of this year when I ran a course for young people who didn't have university entrance to be able to come to university. We had a course that they did, and Pene came and sat in the room for a number of those lectures. And one of the stories that I told was the story of Maui, because I wanted to give these people a sense of why they were at university. And, I could think of no better way to do it than through a myth, because myths are powerful stories that touch elements of being that science doesn't, actually. Science is a marvelous and powerful tool, but it is not the be-all and end-all of life. So I told them the story of Maui, how Maui went to the underworld, which is an incredibly common motif in mythology. It's a delving into the past, because, of course, the underworld is the realm of the dead. And he retrieved from the world of the dead the jawbone of his ancestor. And the jawbone is what we use to speak, but it's a bone and therefore dead. But then in a later story, he went out onto the ocean with his brothers. And the ocean might be taken as a symbol of chaos and disorder. And he has with him this jawbone, which is what his ancestor used to speak with to tell the stories of culture. And he reinvigorated it with his blood, which is life force. And then he used it to retrieve from the ocean, from chaos, order. And serendipitously, that particular fish that he retrieved was called Te Kau Maui, the North Island of New Zealand, the head of which the university is situated on. So it made a very nice kind of story for these young people that they were in an institution situated on the head of this order that had been brought up from chaos through the reinvigoration with life force. Now, that's a powerful story, but it's not scientific. So we don't need to say that, mythology or science is better. There are elements of life that we need to have together. And I would say that, confusing one with the other can devalue both. And unfortunately, I think that's just what the Ministry of Education are currently doing. And I'm going to show you some examples now of standards that are being piloted for a review of NCEA. So first of all, here we've got one from physics, from Earth and Space Science. So it's about demonstrating understanding of the effects of Earth on interactions between the Sun, Earth, Moon system. So astronomy. And in the documentation for this standard, it says that learners can explore how Māori, Pacific, and other indigenous knowledges describe the interaction of Sun, Earth, and Moon, and the implications for life on Earth. So it invites them to bring in mythological explanations to what is supposed to be natural science. Now, as I've just pointed out, I have a great deal of respect for mythological explanations as mythology, because I think they're powerful stories. But to bring them into a science context risks making them a laughingstock, and that is disrespectful. And it can only serve to confuse what science is when you do that as well. So are we to accept that in an astronomy standard, students can respond by saying that, a daughter of Tangaroa pours water over the earth from the moon, and that's what makes it rain. Here's another one. So this is a level one general science standard. Demonstrate claims of understanding of science claims in communicated information. So here it says that the contexts that are chosen for this have to be selected with respect for whānau and ākonga cohort position, in other words, the beliefs of students and their families, the non-scientific beliefs. To avoid a dilemma when family responses differ from mainstream science viewpoints. And they have the gall to call this looking after young people's well-being. Now, I recall before I was born, there was a debate in the United States about the teaching of evolution, because there were states in which were quite strongly creationist in their orientation. They were fundamentalist Christian, and they didn't want evolution taught because it offended them. It was a heretical idea to them. And it seems that our Ministry of Education is trying to reinvent that idea, that we must avoid a science offending anybody or contending ideas that are in disagreement with the religious ones, for example. That to me is not looking after well-being. To look after well-being, we make people resilient. We don't avoid offending them at all costs. This one I find particularly pernicious. This is a level two statistics standard. Actually, it's a set of standards. This is called the big idea. The ministry has this idea, this big idea thing that it puts into all the different learning areas. So data has whakapapa and is a tānga. So it has a lineage and it's a sacred treasure. Observations carry mori, or life force. I don't know what to make of that statement, but the thing that really bothers me is the contention that data is a tānga, because that implies that it is sacred and therefore ought to be insulated from testing. And that is the opposite to what we ought to be teaching kids about what to do in science, of course. Data are to be ruthlessly interrogated until they reveal the best approximation of the truth that we're capable of revealing. And then we're to question them further, because never ought we be satisfied that we've revealed the truth. And of course, we only have to think to history to know what happens when you allow that idea to rule. Copernicus, who I mentioned before, and his successor Galileo, as you'll be aware, was threatened with the Inquisition for questioning sacred ideas. And that's what happens when you allow sacred ideas to take precedence over methods of inquiry like science. And so, you know, what can we do really to protect what is a very, very hard one and very powerful tool that we have? And we have to protect it, because it's given us prosperity. It's given us knowledge beyond the wildest dreams of anybody even 200 years ago. So I mean, the historians in the room will appreciate the need for looking backwards to inform the future. So I'd like to now just explore a few common confusions about what science is. So first of all, and I'm sure none of you are confused about this, but it is a common confusion that technology is somehow science. People think of rocket ships and, you know, miracle drugs, and that's science. Well, no, of course, science produces the knowledge that allows us to build rocket ships and make marvelous medicines, but technology is not itself science. And had that been understood, then, you know, a spurious argument against what the Auckland Seven said would have been immediately debunked, because of course, the Polynesians were marvelous navigators. They were able to traverse enormous stretches of ocean between tiny islands with great accuracy, using very sophisticated information, including sea currents, winds, the flights of birds, and and fish and so on, that they were able to navigate. That is a marvelous technology, but it is not proof that Mataranga Māori is science. Another thing that really bothers me is when I hear somebody say the science is settled, and that's a surefire indication that they're trying to use science as a political weapon to close a debate. Of course, the science is never settled. Science is never settled. And we can think of, you know, climate change and vaccine mandates in that context. And it's not to say that people supporting vaccines are wrong or people concerned about climate change are wrong. But if you attempt to use science to contend that a debate need not be had, you are being anti-scientific. You are using science as a political weapon. You may be right about the substantive issue, but you're in the wrong in the way you are trying to use science. And here, I think, is where we come back to a confluence between Popper's political and scientific philosophy. So in this sense, free speech and science have similar roles because they're about the free contest of ideas. So political ideas, like scientific theories, have to be provisional and subject to revision. They have different mechanisms for doing so, but they have that in common. And no matter how compelling the evidence may seem in favour of a position, if you try to shut down somebody arguing against you, not only are you being anti-scientific and anti-democratic, you may be closing the door to a very good idea, because just occasionally a tiny minority turns out to be right. So for that reason, I would say that, you know, we have to make something of a separation between public debates and scientific debates. Not a complete separation, because of course we would like science to inform public debate and issues of public importance. But we have to be clear about the role of each. So public policy needs to make decisions about things like methods of combating climate change or whether we need to, you know, all have vaccine, whatever. That's a public policy decision. And at a certain point, a decision is taken, and then that is what happens. However, science needs to continue, irrespective of that, to contest the idea. And if people dissent from the dominant view, clearly they need to be able to do so. They need to back it up with evidence, because that's the way science works. But if at a certain point the evidence for their position becomes strong, well, then things will change theoretically. So one of the things that I think does come out of the way we've taught science historically is a confusion about what science is. It gets identified with the theories that it produces. Now, I would say that scientific theories are part of science, but there is something that sits over them, which is science epistemology, the theory of knowledge that sits behind science. And that, I would say, is what the fundamental difference is between science and any other form of knowledge, Mataranga Māori or anything else. Science epistemology is quite unique, and it has some unique features. So we can think about various components of science. One is the theoretical knowledge, and that's what most people learn in school. They learn Newtonian mechanics, and they learn, you know, acids and bases, and they learn cell biology and so on. Then there are investigative methods, how we actually conduct inquiry in science. And, you know, a certain amount of that happens in school science as well. Often it's not terribly well connected to the theoretical component. But actually what unifies those two things are the epistemic principles, because of course when we're conducting an investigation in science, we're testing a theory. And so it is the epistemology of science that actually directs the methods that we're using and the way in which we argue about the evidence in order to provisionally advance a theory. So I would say that these epistemic principles and argumentation are neglected elements of science curriculum. And this has been what Edith and I have spent a lot of time talking about, and what Edith did her master's thesis on, and is now advancing those ideas in her PhD. So perhaps these components need to be more strongly emphasized, the epistemic and the argumentative parts of science. And then I think we could avoid some of this acrimonious stuff that's been going on, because people would be a little clearer about what we're talking about when we say science. So epistemology really is at the heart of science, because it's what allows it to be a tool of producing knowledge. And it is absolutely incompatible with sacred belief. It's the antidote to sacred belief. It's how we cut through, you know, tradition and what we've thought forever, and say, just because we've thought it forever doesn't make it true. So the idea that all ideas are up for grabs, that is an absolute of science epistemology. And that all theories are provisional, that is a corollary of that, really. Now, one of Popper's great insights, or one of his great articulations, I would say, is that our job as scientists is to disconfirm rather than confirm. So when we test theories, we're seeking to falsify them. Now, of course, logicians have taken some issue with falsifiability as a logical structure, but I want to actually argue for it as a dispositional thing, that actually to take a falsificationist philosophy is promotes intellectual humility and the right, and acts as an antidote to things like confirmation bias, to wanting to prove ourselves correct, which is a natural human disposition. So science investigation can provide a link between theory and epistemology, but it needs to be made explicit for young people. It's not just going to, you know, fall out of the air into their laps. Like so many things in education, in the present fashion, we think that children will just discover things for themselves if we put them in a classroom with some stuff. By and large, they won't. One of the important principles here is that cognitive load has to be managed, and I'll explain what I mean by that. When we're teaching, I think this is something that educators need to take very seriously, no matter what they're teaching. And good teachers always have, because they've had an intuition for it, but now we actually have scientific understanding of what that means. So this comes from my discipline of cognitive psychology. And this is a very, very thumbnail sketch of human memory systems. So sensory memory, that's the input from the environment. Visual short-term memory, auditory short-term memory. These things take in all of the sensory properties of the environment that we're capable of taking in, but they represent them for a split second. They will only be preserved if we attend to them. If we do attend to them, then they become represented in another short-term store called working memory. Now, working memory has a very limited capacity, and it will itself decay within seconds unless we continue to rehearse it and continue to concentrate on whatever its contents are. So we can think of the process of learning, or at least the kind of learning that takes place in school, as the transfer of information from working memory to long-term memory, where it becomes much more durable, and long-term memory has essentially infinite capacity. So we can think of two kinds of long-term memory. There's a lot of debate in cognitive psychology about how many memory systems there are, but for present purposes, we can think of procedural memory, which is memory for doing things, like driving cars, playing violins, or playing rugby, for example. And then there's declarative memory, which is propositional knowledge, things that we can state. And of course, science is a mixture of the two, because when we think about science investigations, there are procedures involved. How to use a Bunsen burner, how to titrate, etc. But a lot of the obviously the contents of science tends to be declarative theoretical knowledge. So you can think of short-term or working memory as the store of information that we are presently using in the current moment. And it can be maintained by ongoing attention, but it will decay unless we continue to do that. Now, cognitive load can be thought of as the imposition on working memory created by doing a particular task. So this becomes very important when we're teaching anything complex, because a complex task can't all be held in working memory at once. I've spent a number of years teaching research methods to master's students in education. And a lot of middle-aged teachers come and do this degree, and a goodly proportion of them are terrified of statistics. And the reason they are is because when they were younger, it was taught to them in a way, or mathematics was taught to them in a way that didn't pay respect to cognitive load. And consequently, they became cognitively overwhelmed and then confused and concluded that they were no good at mathematics. Tragically, that is almost certainly not true. The problem is that we need to automatize each step before we proceed to the next one. And by automatize, I mean transfer to long-term memory. That requires practice and repetition. Once it's happened, that is a firm foundation to build on. So managing cognitive load is a vital component of teaching complex things. So if we think about using science investigation to advance understanding of science epistemology, we have three things, each of which imposes a cognitive load. First is the theory being tested. So you have to understand Newtonian mechanics and its equations. The next is the investigative procedures that you're going to use to test a theory. And the third is the epistemic principles. And if these things are all novel at once, you've got no show. So we need to separate them for teaching purposes, for pedagogical purposes. All right, so now I'll just turn briefly to what I think is missing from science education. First, I've talked about epistemology already. The other thing is the argumentative side. So I would say falsificationism as a disposition. So rather than as a strict logical tool, as an attitude. And, you know, dare I say it, as an antidote to cancel culture. Adrian, how nice to see you. Because it is an intellectually humble position. It's a position that we take when we are not sure of ourselves and we think that we may be wrong. So let's try to prove ourselves wrong. And if we fail, then we can be a little more confident in what we thought. So this is the sort of work that Batiste was doing on argumentative reasoning. So the argumentative theory of reasoning says that actually reasoning works best when we're trying to evaluate theories than when trying to construct them. So when we're producing an argument and reasoning it for ourselves, first of all, we are susceptible to confirmation bias. We like our own ideas a bit too much. We're not very good at critiquing them, and we're lazy. We don't think up all of the best counterarguments that we could. However, if we're engaged in reasoning with others and testing one another's ideas, you know, other people are going to be more demanding. They only want to be convinced by good arguments, not by our crappy ones that we're happy to convince ourselves with. And also, you know, they can be a bit objective. They are open to being convinced if a good argument is advanced. Now, argumentative reasoning can be successfully taught to 8-year-olds. And that's what Batiste was engaged in doing. And we did it as well with the provisional entry students who I talked about before. And I was a bit nervous about doing it with them because, you know, I've read John Hyatt's book about how young people are a bit fragile. And I think there is a lot of depression and anxiety with young people at the moment. But I was amazed by how readily they wanted to do this. I started with, you know, pretty non-controversial or non-contentious things, but and I intended to do it only for 1 week, but at the end of the session they collectively said, let's do that again next week and let's talk about much more controversial things. So this is the exercise, is that you just get them in a circle and they speak one at a time, and you obviously have rules of decorum that you argue in good faith and that you don't attack people and so on. And they got so much out of it in a couple of hours. And I do think that if we did this kind of exercise routinely with younger people, starting at about age 8, we would cultivate a generation of not scientists, but young people who were ready to take on scientific thinking. So just to sum up briefly, I think that epistemic aspects of science need to be explicitly taught, not left in the background. And, you know, investigation can be a sound approach, but we need to think about cognitive load and manage that. And we can cultivate the disposition to think like a scientist long before children are ready for the cognitive complexity of science itself. If we do these things, we may be able to clarify what science is, to improve science itself in our society and its contribution, the contributions it makes, and, you know, to go right back full circle to Karl Popper, to strengthen democracy by building resilience to, you know, so-called offensive ideas. But actually, ideas are never offensive if they're argued with evidence and good faith. Thank you.